So again, this is joint work with Charles Favre, and it's in a preprint on the archive called Dynamical Compactification of Stations of C2. So let's see. So anyway, this is going to combine the methods a little bit over the previous two talks, especially the second, I guess. So what we're going to look at here is, again, I'm always sticking to dimension two, and I think especially for this talk, it's very much unclear what to do in higher dimensions for the questions I want to ask. Because even automorphisms in C3, it's kind of a little bit poorly understood, unless you make assumptions. Anyway, so what we want to do here is we want to study the behavior. Later on I'll have some specific questions I want to answer, but generally I want to study the behavior of the iterates of F at infinity. So there is some kind of analogy between the local situation, which I discussed yesterday, when you have a fixed point germ at the origin in C2, and especially if you blow up the origin, in some sense you have something a little bit similar. You have a P1 and the neighborhood of P1 and a dynamical system there. But there are some main differences here which complicate things. Because first of all, in general, I don't necessarily want to restrict my attention to proper polynomial mapping. So there's it's not true that you can just say that F infinity is infinity in any sense. Of course, you could restrict yourself to proper polynomial maps, but somehow the same kind of problem was going to show up anyway, as we'll see later. And then there is another. Well, this is a little vague, but somehow it's not as local situation as in C2 at the origin, because if you want to construct something holomorphic in a little vague sense, defined in the neighborhood of infinity in C2, well, just by some Hartog phenomenon, somehow you have to really define it in all of P2. So then you have the compact setting, and it's much more rigid. So this, in a way, will show up. All right. So again, it's going you want to look at this both, this is a particular case of just a meromorphic self-map of, in this case, a rational self-map of P2, for example. But it does still have some of these features. It still has some kind of local behavior. You can localize it at infinity for whatever that's worth. So we're going to try to combine that. But in fact, most of what I'll do is from the second lecture. Right. So can recall the following. Recall these two dynamical degrees. So in this case, there are only two. So there's a topological degree. And then there is this asymptotic degree, which can be defined in this way. So here, degree of F is just, F is a pair of polynomials, and it's just the maximum degrees of those two. Or if you want, you just take a line, and you take the preimage of a generic line, and just check what degree it has. And the case when lambda 1 is 1 is kind of special here, and it can also be treated, but I think just to be safe, I'm going to assume that lambda 1 is bigger than 1 for the most part here. All right. So then one thing that you can try to figure out is just how do the degrees actually grow more specifically. So it turns out, so this is a theorem which in a way generalizes the result by Friedland and Milner for polynomial automorphisms. But here in the non-invertible case, you basically have the same behavior. So either you have exponential growth like this, but what I mean here is, there's a constant term and then a much smaller term. So I guess the ratio tends to be a constant, but you have a little bit more precise. I'll come to later. And the other case, then it grows like a linear function in n times this lambda 1 to the n. And in the second case, f is conjugate to a skew product. So conjugate means that you can change variables by polynomial automorphism to get this. All these statements should be, they're birational invariant, or at least invariant by change of coordinates. So in that second case, then you have a skew product of this type. And then, in fact, if you have some relations between the degrees of P and Q, then you can cook up, or you can see when this is going to happen. You need the degree of P to be the same as degree of in Y of Q, and you need some other. It shouldn't be like a monic polynomial in Y or something. And the second theorem is just the same as in the local case. So there was a C infinity, which plays the same role somehow, measuring how fast orbits are attracted to the origin. Here there's lambda 1, in some sense measures how fast typical orbits are attracted to infinity. And again, this is going to be a quadratic integer. Yeah. So what is the, well, I mean, it's a silly example. This is lambda 1 equal to 1 if you just have x comma, xy goes to x comma xy or something.
Well, I was thinking maybe something with a little more
expansion. Well, x squared comma xy squared or something.
Okay.
Just not say, yeah, if you just take a monomial example, it's going to be. All right. And then, in fact, the degree growth satisfies an integral recursion formula of this form, so where with integer coefficients. So this n, I guess we haven't really thought too much about it, but it definitely doesn't have to be 2 or anything, or yeah. So even though it's a quadratic, just because it's a quadratic integer doesn't mean that you have a recursion of order 2. And so the approach is to try to, I mean, these are kind of algebraic statements or something, but you want to study the dynamics at infinity to understand what's going on here.
Sorry,
yeah.
So for each little n, you find aj.
No, 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 no.
For every n, you have those.
Yeah, yeah, so the aj's, there are finitely many of them, so then this is true for, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, this would imply that lambda 1 is an algebraic integer, but in fact, it turns out to be quadratic. So well, it's a little bit complementary. I mean, it's not so, if you take a simple example like something you had yesterday, x comma y maps to y comma xy or something, then you see the Fibonacci sequence. So it's, I mean, and in many cases, I think this sequence is going to be quite simple, but it could be, there could be something to it. Right. Oops, didn't work. So what did I forget to do? All right, so again, there are going to be a lot of blow-ups here, as usual. So basically what we're going to look at is, you look at the dynamics at infinity, but infinity, usually maybe you think of just compactifying by P2 or something. So, well, in a way we're going to do that, but not only that. So, well, first of all, we're going to fix an embedding of C2 into P2. And this is mainly just to, this is a way to talk about what affine functions are in C2 or even the degree of a polynomial. I mean, if you haven't really fixed an embedding, you can't really, well, you haven't really. Yeah, you should do this. All right, but then having fixed that embedding, now we'll just define an admissible compactification for the purpose of this talk. It's just obtained from P2 by blowing up finitely many points at infinity. You don't blow up anything in C2 because somehow everything is well-behaved there already, so there's no point. Or in any case, it wouldn't necessarily be a compactification. Let me have a picture here. So then there's another piece of notation, the primes, or the exceptional prime divisors, in some sense. So these are the irreducible components of the complement of this compactification in C2. So it will include the line at infinity, but then it will be other things. So here, you start with P2, you only have the line at infinity. So maybe here you blow up 2 points. You get 2 exceptional divisors, so these are new primes, and then maybe here you blow up that point and the intersection point, and intersection point creates a new exceptional divisor, kind of separating the previous two, and then and so on. So you can blow up. And again, you're going to identify primes with their strict transforms. So the L infinity here, for the most part, I'll identify this with its strict transform, which is this horizontal curve here, et cetera. All right, so what can you do with these? So there's a theorem which is, it's just a bit similar to, well, actually, I'm pictured. So it's a bit similar to what I had in a local situation, except there's one more ingredient which I guess is also true in the local, but we didn't, well, it's not written out. But here I think it's more important also. So I'm going to formulate this. I mean, there are various results. For simplicity, I'm going to stick to the case of low topological degree, because the way the statement is written here, it's not going to be true necessarily in all cases. But this is the easiest one to describe, and I'll try to explain how you can get to this later on. So what you can find then, you can find one of these admissible compactifications, which meaning you just find some good blow-ups of P2 at infinity, and you can find a point at infinity, so in this case it's a point here, intersection point, and you find some possibly large integer n, such that you have some nice property that, just as in the local case, you get a nice it's going to be super attracting fixed point here at infinity. So P is a nice fixed point, and not only that, I mean, it's so here, I guess it's really in the local case, it would tell us you already started with something holomorphic, but here there's really no, I mean, you really have to blow up to construct this thing. And it's not obvious that such a thing exists. And you're also going to have some simple normal forms here. So one of the normal forms is just a monomial normal form. So you find if you're in an intersection point like this, then you have coordinates z and w for the two axes, and then the map becomes monomial in those coordinates. And then there's another case, which I don't want to write down. But then the third property is that if you look at any of these exceptional prime divisors, these primes, they're going to be collapsed under this large iterate onto P. So, I mean, if you take a generic point on one of these, it's going to just be sent to P. Of course, there are points of indeterminacy, so it's not like it's just holomorphically sent, but still. And it just is, well, it's a little bit annoying. There could be one exception in some special cases when F happens to be a skew product, and you could have some special. But that's, in that case, if there is an exception, I should write this. If there is an exception, that one is actually fixed by F, so it doesn't really cause any problem. Okay. So what you can do, you can actually deduce theorems B and C from this. So theorem B, well, no, I don't, maybe I should actually put it up. Well, that's maybe too complicated. Well, this is going to be complicated here. See if I can handle it. So theorem B was that, well, this is a quadratic integer, so, well, I kind of mentioned that quickly at the end, that follows from, if you have this monomial form, then basically what you get is this quadratic integer is the spectral radius of a 2x2 matrix. Well, it's a little bit cheating to say that like that, but I would say more importantly, so where does this thing come from? And this recursion formula. Well, this statement here, well, so maybe it doesn't exactly follow from this statement, but if for simplicity we just assume that F, you can replace F by this huge iterate F to the N. Suppose you can, this is true with N equal to 1. Well, then of course the map is, you can just check it's algebraically stable on this model. So in the trivial sense, I mean, if it would not be algebraically stable, there would be some curve that's contracted to a point and then blown up. Well, what could that curve be? It could not be a curve in C2, because curve in C2 can be contracted, but certainly not blown up again, because you're nice in C2. So it has to be something at infinity, but here we're saying that they're all contracted at this point P, and then they just stay there. So it's algebraically stable in a very strong sense. And once you're algebraically stable, well, so this degree thing here, I mean, this recursion relation is just, you take the action on the cohomology, the H11 of the corresponding X, and that's just given by, and then basically a matrix with integer coefficients, and then the characteristic polynomial gives you the recursion. Okay, so then to show that you actually don't have to replace F by an iterate, you have to do a little bit more work, but that's, I'm not going to go into that. So what you can also do here, which I think is perhaps more important and links a little bit more to the previous talks here, or the other talks, is that you can study, and you can get dynamical information from this. So in any case, you can try to define a green function like this, which just measures the rate of growth of orbits to infinity, like this. But and you can do this for any polynomial map, but there's no reason why this limit would exist or have any good properties. So here, So I'm not going to say what I mean by well-behaved, but it behaves more or less exactly in the same way as you would expect for a Hanel map, for example, polynomial diffeomorphism. And then you can work with that, and so Diller, Desjardins, and Gedge, I guess, have used this to kind of for their program for studying maps of low topological degree. You get one nice class of examples where somehow the right conditions are satisfied. All right, so I'll focus on this theorem here, and well, the theorem A to some extent as well, these degree growth. See if I can get this. Oops. I guess I need to. Oh, now I get kind of screwed up here. All right. So there are two approaches here to study things. So one is this Riemann-Zariski approach. So I'm not going to go through any details here, but I will give. I'll just kind of recall definitions and note. I mean, so what was this idea that you, well, what we did before, we had a meromorphic surface, well, we just had a surface, I guess, compact Kähler surface, and then you kind of take the projective limit as you just made finite blow-ups of that surface. So here we can do the same thing, but we only blow up at infinity. So, because somehow, there's no reason, everything is already fine on C2, so there's no point of kind of touching that. So if you want, this is just saying that you take all these admissible compactifications and then the projective limit. And again, the space is not something I want to study the space itself, but I want to have this formally having various cohomology classes living on that space. So here you have these, and again, here H11, I mean, somehow things are very algebraic here, so you can look at the Picard groups or your favorite kind of space here, Nernst-Savery group. Things are much more explicit, but in any case, you have the projective limit. So just this means that giving a cohomology class in each compactification, compatible on the push forward, and then you have the ones that happen to be determined in a given model. And then you can define this completion, the L2 space, and you have also the positive inner notion of net classes. And here, you can check that you have some very natural actions by push forward and pullback on these they own all these classes, basically. I mean, there's some, not a very subtle point, but there is one issue that, I mean, there was this Zariski lemma that, Zariski fact that if you had an exceptional prime somewhere, you could blow up the target space to make sure that this thing was not contracted. Well, that's not strictly speaking true here, because what could happen is that you have an exceptional divisor in a prime at infinity, which actually gets sent to a point in C2. And then you're not allowed to blow up the target. But on the other hand, that doesn't really cause any problems, because once you're in C2, you're fine. So, I mean, there are some small differences here, but they're really... So the point is, F is holomorphic on C2, and that's invariant, so you don't have to touch anything there. All right, so then you can prove just verbatim the same thing. It's, I mean, again, there's this kind of Perrin-Frobenius type statement. And here I need to assume that, well, actually, for the second statement, I need to assume that the topological degree is not the maximal one it can be. So in any case, there are these, well, the first made statement that there always exists these Neff eigenclasses with the right eigenvalues, and they are unique if this condition is satisfied. They're unique up to scaling, and you have the convergence. So here I only care actually about one of the... I only care about push forward for this statement, but it's true. The same is true also for the pullback. And I want to write this slightly more here. So for any, I guess for alpha in L2, then you have this thing converges to a multiple of this Ford invariant thing. But I want to be emphasized here. So there is this constant actually. I mean, you have an explicit constant. It's not a big deal, but actually this will show up later. Because what could happen, which you have to watch out for, is that this constant is zero, for instance. I mean, if alpha is Neff, which is the one case we're going to look at, then, well, this might be zero, and then it doesn't give any information, really. Well, it gives some information, but not too much. Okay. So So this will kind of be a powerful result, but it will only come in later. So let's see here. I want to do this. So instead, I want to look at this approach using valuations. So it's kind of similar to the local case, but there are some subtle differences. So, all right. So you have valuation is a function on the ring. So here the ring is just say C of x y. So it's a coordinate ring of C2. And then you want to look at valuations on that ring. And here they're going to take values that could be negative or positive. I do include the value plus infinity. I don't include negative infinity. And I want them to be centered at infinity. So really what this means is that on P2, on any compact base evaluation like this will have a center, which is either a variety, a subvariety, or a point, and that point is at infinity. So, but what it really means is that there is some polynomial where the value is negative. And then I can normalize it. So and the normalization is that now you have a bunch of affine functions. So that's why we wanted to embed it in P2, so you know what the affine functions are. And I want to say that, in fact, the minimum value on affine functions is negative 1. And in fact, this just means that I pick a randomly chosen generic function L, then the value is negative 1. So here you should think of, the evaluation just in the local case, it's the order of vanishing. Here it's also order of vanishing, but since it is at infinity, typically a polynomial will have negative order of vanishing. We'll have a pole at infinity. But not necessarily. It could also have, that's a tricky thing. It could have a pole, but it could actually have a zero as well if the polynomial is adapted. So that kind of complicates things. So what are these valuations? Well, the most natural ones geometrically are these divisorial valuations. So they appear just as they did in the local case. So once you have the admissible compactification here of C2, now you pick in the prime E. And that gives you, you can define the order of vanishing along that divisor. So again, it's just to take the polynomial, it defines a rational function on the compactification, so it's going to have some order of vanishing, or maybe it could be a pole, but along E, and that's just the number you get, so it's an integer. Well, that's not the normalized valuation, so we want to get this nice tree structure later on, we want to normalize them, and there's a normalization constant, which is something like that. So one example here is if this prime you're looking at is just the line of infinity or maybe the strict transform, well, what is this thing? Well, the order of vanishing is just minus the degree of the polynomial. So I want to understand this space, or these two spaces, I guess. So you kind of do exactly the same thing. And again, there are some subtle differences that will show up later, but here, so far, you can look at dual graphs. So if you have an admissible compactification of C2, just P2 blown up a bunch of times, then you have a dual graph. So again, the vertices of this dual graph are exactly these primes, the irreducible components of the exceptional divisor, and then you have edges here between L infinity and F that just signifies that L infinity, which happens to this guy, intersects F. And again, you can put some structure on this thing. There has a partial ordering. I mean, it has it's a simplicial complex that's a tree. There are no cycles, and so you can pick. You can pick your minimal element or your root of the tree as anything you want, but here it makes sense to pick it as just a line of infinity. And then that gives you a partial ordering on this. And you can also define a metric on it in this way that you had BE and BF was the order of vanishing along E of a generic affine function. And if you define it in this way, then you get a metric. And you have the same kind of thing. So if you have two compactifications dominating, well, one dominating another, it just means that you have x and then you make some further blow-ups, you get x prime, then what you do is you kind of enlarge this graph. I mean, you maybe you subdivide some edges and maybe you attach some new edges, but the partial ordering and the metric just stays the same. And what you now also can do, so I'm not going to follow exactly what happens in the local case, you have an embedding of this dual graph into the set of valuations. So again, how did that work? Well, each, you have to embed, first you embed the vertices, you think. So the vertices, these are these prime divisors. So they, so to them you associate these normalized divisorial valuations. Well, so then you have the edges. Well, the edges corresponds to here L infinity and F, that corresponds to an intersection point. You pick some local coordinates there, so Z and W, and then you parameterize that segment by S and T, satisfying something as S, something as T is one, and then you define monomial valuations in the coordinates upstairs. So that will give you. And this is, all this is compatible with this kind of thing that when you make further laws. And then slightly more complicated, you have a retraction. So given a valuation, you can define its center on any model, and it's going to be its center at infinity. So it is, the center is somewhere at infinity. But not only that, you can also give, if the center is, it happens to be at the intersection point between L infinity and F, then in fact you can specify exactly where on this segment the retraction is going to lie, because it depends on the values on the defining function Z and W of the coordinates there. Right. And then what you can prove, which, again, I don't want to do that, but it's actually not that hard if you do everything right, that this normalized valuation space is the projective limit of these dual graphs. And again, we're kind of lucky. I mean, these projective limits in general, these horrible constructions, so you don't see them at all. It's like the Riemann-Zariski space I don't want to try to describe in this setting. But here, it's the projective limit, I mean, just means that you have these dual graphs and you make them bigger and bigger. And the things that, some of the points that you didn't have in any dual graph, they're just kind of endpoints in the tree you get. So it's a very simple, it's very easy to understand, or very easy, but it's at least a very, it's quite possible to understand what happens with this projective limit. So one of the problems in higher dimensions, I mean, I'm not going to say anything more about that, but I mean, you can kind of try to play the same game. I mean, you have various difficulties, but you can imagine, and which is true here, that you have various dual graphs. Well, now they're higher dimensional simplicial complexes. And a theorem like this can be proved, that there's a predictive limit. But the problem is you have to put a lot of stuff at infinity, and it's very hard to understand what you have to put there. Maybe you have to put a lot of trees, you have to put, I don't know. But here it's, so it is an R tree, and the R tree, you can define it in various ways. You could define it just kind of in a soft way using a partial ordering. You could also define it really has a metric, so, and there is a more standard definition of being an R tree as a metric space. It is uniquely geodesic, and somehow paths are isometric to real intervals. All right. Oh, yeah. Okay. So now we have this tree, and we have we also have this with a hat space. So basically, this with a hat is just a cone over the space. So I forgot to say, so then one nice thing here is, well, one satisfying thing is that the space is, there's a natural topology on it, so it's compact. So I didn't quite define, I mean, I wasn't very specific in this statement here. I mean, this projective limits, these kind of spaces tend to be compact because each dual graph is compact, and this is basically a product construction. So by Tikhonov's theorem, this is compact. But you also have the space evaluations is just kind of functions, the function space, so that's also compact. And well, anyway, that's kind of satisfying to work on that. Anyway, so now we want to define. So how do I want to say? All right. We want to define some actions here on valuations. So there was a slight problem in the local case. You can define a push forward on a valuation just by. I mean, the value on a polynomial P would be the value of nu on the pullback of P. So in the local case, that basically always worked. I mean, there's a very, very minor issue with the map. It's dominant, but not finite. But that's not really a problem. But here, this does work. There's no problem in itself if the map is proper. But certainly, if it's not proper, then you have a bigger problem. So maybe this picture is not so good. So there's no reason for this to be centered at infinity in general. So what will happen is, but on the other hand, if you have the, if the revelation is the line of, of course, so to say, the line of infinity, certainly the line of infinity is not mapped down in C2. So there is going to be some domain or definition here of this F, or actually it's rather, well, both of these, I mean, this are defined. So the with the dot here, the bullet, is just a normalized version. So there's going to be some subtree where this is defined, and so what I'm trying to, this is, doesn't view very well, so the green stuff here is where it is defined, and then there's some kind of a lot of branches sprouting out where basically those valuations are sent into C2. But you get a nice map here, so from this domain onto the whole space. It respects the tree structure in this kind of sense, that basically segments are mapped to segments, at least possibly have to subdivide them a little bit, and then there's, well, it sends a segment in a homeomorphic way, and it has a, basically it's surjective as well. I mean, it depends, you have to worry about those endpoints there, but so you have a, right, but of course here there's a problem, because I mean, at least it's not, this is in itself not a problem if you have proper maps, but certainly if you only have dominant maps, you have a problem. This domain or definition depends on F, so it's not clear you can do any dynamics at all here. Well, but the answer is yes here, so you can actually do that. So you can actually have a domain where all of this is defined. And in fact, you want more than this question. I guess you want something a little canonical here where you can do meaningful dynamics. But as I said, I mean, it's not so hard to see that. I mean, the domain cannot be empty, because if you take the line at infinity, certainly for any polynomial map, that's not going to be sent to down in C2 somewhere. That's going to stay at infinity. Maybe it's contracted, who knows? But so that is, if nothing else, that is inside the domain or definitions of all those guys for any F. But you want a little bit more. So then you get, so here is, let's say, the first real main, the first main difference to the local case is that so there is a, it's supposed to be a subtree V1. Anyway, so there is a, so what happens here, there are kind of parametrizations of this tree. So I don't want to go too much into detail of this, but I mean, basically the point is that this, there is a subtree that somehow measures that points that are sufficiently close to this root of the tree. There you're fine, but you have to define this in a specific way. So this is a little bit technical, but it has a nice geometric interpretation that I'll come to in a second here. So there are parameterizations of the tree, which just measures basically how far you are from being at the root of the tree. So there are two of them, which have some randomly chosen names here. That the first one, so it's actually the value at the root is 1, and then it can go all the way to negative infinity at some of the ends. And the other one, the thinnest here, is -2 at the root, and then it's infinity. So here, this is really, so you remember at, on the dual graphs, there was a distance, which I defined, and that distance can be, that also becomes a distance on the whole big tree. So this alpha is 1 minus the distance to the root. And this thinnest is something that shows up a lot in algebraic geometry. I mean, certain people deal with the multiplier deals, and I mean, it's not a big mystery in any case. But and I think there is even some name which is not log discrepancy. But so what you do here is that you just take a two form in C2, just dx wedge dy and non-vanishing. So now you can, this is going to extend to a rational form at infinity. And then you can take its order of vanishing. It's going to have poles, or either zeros or poles along exceptional divisors. And then it turns out that you put a 1 here. So that's the value at the divisorial valuation, non-normalized. And if it's normalized, well, then you just divide. So it turns out, so this is a somehow very natural object. Then you define, you're in this tree if you have a couple of inequalities like this. And the second inequality is, I mean, well, I'm probably going to say wrong, but there are various, I mean, people in dealing with singularities in algebraic geometry have various notions of log canonical and so on. I mean, this is in the same spirit. The second condition is in that spirit. So here is some kind of picture. that you have the big tree. Well, so the big tree kind of spreads out, and then you have a kind of subtree here that things are sufficiently closed in a suitable sense to the root. Okay? So, well, this, so far this is just a definition, but it turns out that this is a very nice thing to work with. And why is that? Huh? So there are some very nice properties. I mean, even before doing any dynamics, you have some nice properties here. So first of all, just one of these conditions is about this skewness. And so what can happen, if you have this valuation, then in fact, the value of any polynomial is negative. So meaning that any polynomial has a pole on that valuation. And in fact, you have an effective bound here. So in terms of the degree of the polynomial and this constant here. Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's so. I don't think it behaves very well under further blowups. So I don't. I'm not sure. I mean, it might be interesting. I don't know. But somehow I think the one forms it is of. It's not a one-dimensional space, so I think it's more complicated. Right? Well, I mean, in just the. I mean, it's still a vector bundle, right? Oh, it's just a line bundle as opposed to... Right. It's a vector bundle, so... Yeah. Right, so here's a very nice classification result, which, so this, well, this relies on, or at least comes in the same package as what's called the line embedding theorem, but I'm just going to state it here. So the line embedding by Abhyankar Mohl and Suzuki. So here, if you have a specific element, so there's some endpoints in this tree, not all endpoints, but some special ones that are divisorial ones, and they have this, there are endpoints in this way. Then, in fact, the valuation has a very nice geometric description. So what's the following description is, so here is the C2 you're really looking at, and but I'm saying that, well, there isn't change of variables by polynomial automorphism, so if you start by just the vibration here by x equal to constant, if you apply polynomial automorphism, then this pencil here becomes some other pencil of curves, and these are going to be curves in one place at infinity. So they're going to have some kind of, they're nice in C2, but they have some kind of singularity here. And the valuation you get is you just take a random, you select one of these fibers at random, you restrict your polynomial there, and you look at the order of vanishing at infinity, and then times a suitable normalization constant. So again, the line embedding theorem says that basically if you have one of these curves with one place at infinity, which you have to define, but then you can straighten them, you can really make it into just a straight line by a polynomial automorphism. So again, this comes in the same package. So that's one nice thing. Right. Well, then, there's another thing that's nice about these this subtree here. So it's supposed to be tight compactifications. So somehow, I mean, most of the valuations that we're going to look at come from dual graphs. So you can try to say, is there some kind of geometric notion corresponding to this? And there is. So you're saying that you have to look at one of these admissible compactifications. You have blown up P2 a bunch of times. And then you define X to be tight if for every prime divisor of X, the corresponding valuation lies in B1. So you could, well, in fact, you can reformulate this purely geometrically. You don't really have to pass to this valuation space, but I don't want to do that. But the main point is there's some kind of restriction on how you blow up from P2 to come to X. So let's look at two examples here. So here's something that's not tight. So you start with a line at infinity, you blow up a point, then you get a new exceptional divisor, and now you blow up a new point on that and not the intersection point. So then you get L infinity, E1, and E2. And this one, E2, will be problematic. And specifically, it's going to satisfy that the problem here is this for the skewness, this alpha, but basically what's going to happen is that if you pick you can pick a straight line that passes to this point, but also passing through that point. And the corresponding affine function will have negative value. It was going to it's going to have a zero along E2, and that's not allowed. In the second case, you blow up differently, although it's also an E1, E2. So first you blow up a point, but then you blow up an intersection point, and then you're fine. And then you have to, anyway. So, and here, I mean, I'm not really going to use this, but there's kind of very nice properties for these geometric, these compactifications. I don't think these have appeared anywhere else, but they seem to be kind of natural objects in their own right. So in general, we have the class of nets, well, cohomology classes, or in this case, line bundles or whatever, so divisors. In general, this is a cone. Within this is a cone inside a finite dimensional vector space. But in general, this is a very messy cone. It's very hard to describe. But in this case, it's the simplest possible cone. It's just a span by the smallest possible number of extremal rays. And you can describe the extremal rays as well. And there's another thing which is interesting geometrically, that every Neff line bundle, in fact, on X is generated by global sections. So I'm not going to use this, but it seems just illustrate that these are natural from some. So there's certainly none of those properties are not true in general for other for general admissible compactification. I mean, I don't think it's an if and only if statement, but it's right. So now the point is, so you have nice, these valuations seem natural, but they're also well adapted to doing dynamics. So let's go back to polynomial map. You have this subtree. And so first, I'm not really going to prove this, but it's not difficult. So first is that you get a well-defined map on V1, so the domain of definition contains this, and it's also invariant. So you have a space like a subtree where you can do dynamics. So if the map was proper, of course you could replace V1 by V0, but as we'll see, we'll actually lose something later on. So then just by kind of tree arguments, at least there exists some eigenvaluation, just an invariant point here. And then, well, so here I'm going to choose a little bit. So here is, I'm cheating a little bit, but not too much. So theorem A was of what behavior of this degree of f to the n. So there are two cases, basically. Well, it's like kind of one more case, but you have to, I don't want to discuss that. So the first nice case, if this happens to be this very special pencil valuation associated to a pencil of rational curves from one place at infinity, well, you saw that that was basically, by changing coordinates, that just became, that was just like x equal to constant, the simplest possible pencil you can imagine. And you can show that if that's invariant, well, it's kind of believable, I guess, that f is then a skew product. And since it preserves a vertical vibration or something. And if you have a skew product, and then you can also check that degree growth. And this, there's a little bit more to it, but that's when you get that the degrees grow like n times lambda 1 to the n. Okay. And in the second case, so this appeared, this was some other case that happened in a local situation, that if the eigenvaluation had positive skewness, so it was certainly, if it's not at the boundary, then you're fine. If you're at the boundary, you have to worry. Then, in fact, you have a, there was a bound that any polynomial had really a pole along that valuation, not a zero, and it was even an effective bound. So, in fact, you're going to get this kind of bound, and that the degree of f to the n is greater than equal to lambda 1 to the n times the constant, and this constant is just explicit like that. And again, there's one more case where, so the other case is when the endpoint and where the eigenvaluation has zero skewness but is not of this form. Then it has to be, it's called an infinitely singular valuation, and but it doesn't really cause any problems. Right. So here's a kind of a, so the first, there's a remark here which helps actually when lambda 2 is less than lambda 1, low topological degree, you cannot have a divisorial eigenvaluation. It's just a, so the problem with, one problem with this exposition is that what does it mean to be an eigenvaluation? Well, the simplest case to describe is that you just have an invariant prime divisor, just it maps to itself. And then this lambda 1 is somehow the order of ramification along it. But in any case, in that case, you can check that you can just compute the topological degree, and it's greater than or equal to lambda 1. So, but it turns out that for many of the other, actually the divisorial case is a pain to treat. So it's actually, for proving things along the way, it's much, much better if you can rule out that case. So that's why, I for some purposes, it's nice to have this. And the second is just a curious remark that if you have a eigenvaluation of a very special form, then you have to have a counterexample to the Jacobian conjecture. I don't think that's a good approach. But anyway. So let's look at the, well, so there's one thing. So I have talked a lot about valuations. I said I would combine the methods of this Riemann-Zariski point of view also, and it comes in exactly here, although I'm not going to say too much about it. But what you can, so what we have here, we have some dynamics on this space V1, the smaller tree, and you said that, well, just by there has to be some fixed point just for topological reasons, essentially. But a priori, there's no reason why this wouldn't be an attracting fixed point, certainly not globally. But here it comes in this Perrin-Frobenius statement. So if you have this condition on the topological degree not being the maximal one, then in fact you have a global attraction on V1 with at most one exception. And that if that exception has to be, is very special. It usually doesn't exist, but if it does, then anyway, you have a lot of control. So here's kind of how the story goes. You associate, so what you can do in general, you can associate a veil class to any valuation. And in general, this is, well, most of the time this is an L2 class, but if you're in this nice, in this subtree, then you have a net veil class, and you have this kind of formalism that when you push forward the veil class, you get the same class associated to the evaluation. And then, well, since you have convergence on veil classes now, you can translate that into convergence on valuations. Well, there's one thing. I'm not going to pull up the slide again, but there was a convergence on the veil classes. I mean, you converge to the right class, but times a constant. And that constant, in this case, it's non-negative, but it could be zero, and exactly zero if you have this. But this class has zero self-intersection bias. So by the Hodge index theorem, the only possibility is actually if you have exactly that class. So it has to be unique, and it's extremely special, and you can say a lot of things. So you also see that the kind of the attracting eigenclass is Z lower star. I didn't write it out. I mean, the attracting is associated to the eigenvaluation. So you can get a lot. Right. So how do you construct a class associated to evaluation? Well, there's some kind of duality here. So I'm just going to say it when you have a divisorial evaluation. Otherwise, you have to do some approximation, and it becomes more than I want to say. But here it's kind of a nice construction that if you have a prime divisor and an admissible compactification, well, so then you want to define the associated divisor. Well, it's going to be a Cartier class defined on this X, and it's defined dually. So when you intersect against any other exceptional prime, you're going to get either 1 or 0. It's 1 if it's 0. And this makes sense because by Poincaré duality, you have a unimodular form, so you can solve equations like this. All right, so here's again the proof of theorem D. So theorem D was the existence of, when you have small topological degree lambda 2 less than lambda 1, so then there exists compactification, a point and an integer. So what the statement is that there's a point at infinity, so that the induced kind of rational map here F twiddle actually is holomorphic and has a nice fixed point there. And for any other prime is going to be collapsed under f to the n to p with one possible exception. Well, now this is essentially a translation here. So, I said that this eigenvaluation cannot be divisorial, which is actually a good thing. So I'm going to assume for simplicity that it's an irrational valuation. So it lies on a dual graph, but it's not somehow an irrational point on a segment in a dual graph. So it will never, however many points you kind of subdivide that segment by blowing up, it's never going to become a vertex. So what you can do then is you can blow up the center of New Star many times. So I don't know if I have basically what's going to happen is that you have, so it lies on a dual graph, so it's in between E and F here. E and F, and if you want, you could blow up the intersection point in EF, and then you subdivide the segment, and your valuation is going to lie in one of those. So in doing this, you get smaller and smaller. You always get some segment containing this valuation. You can make it very small. And you get a very small kind of region here, U of P, associated to that. And in fact, this U of P is of this geometric form. It's the set of valuations whose center on this X is exactly P. So, and it turns out here that this configuration you create in this way is tight, so it has, you blow up, and just because you know that the eigenvaluation is in V1, you can check that this is actually nice. So then the argument is a little bit the same way, so you still have to have this Riemann Zariski business doesn't give you everything. You still have to have some kind of local attraction here, that the segment between E and F is mapped strictly into itself. But that follows from a kind of separate argument, but by the map on that segment was essentially a Möbius map with positive integer coefficients. So then you get that, and then by tree reasons, you get that U of P is mapped into itself. And that just means that F is holomorphic at that point as a fixed point. And then you can prove it, you can make it monomial in this case, because you can control the critical set. It's a rigid germ, so the only critical set you see locally comes from these intersections of E and F, and then it's kind of an exercise to prove that it's monomial. So this just follows the same way as, most of this is the same way as in the local case. But then the last ingredient is that you want to show that all these guys, other exceptional divisors, are contracted to P. Well, this is just a statement that any exceptional prime with one exception that is converges to new star, and if you translate that actually means that it means that when you iterate one of these guys, eventually it's going to be inside this green region here, the green zone, right? And then and that means its center on that model is this point P, and that just means exactly that it's collapsed to this point. And then again, there could be one possible exception, but it's just a special case. And then anyway, it doesn't create a problem. I guess there are 5 minutes left, but I'm actually done, so I'll stop here.